From time to time, you hear news of Christians being arrested for being Christians. They are arrested and detained because they are practicing their Christian faith. Now, immediately when I say that, you know that I'm talking about someplace overseas, don't you? I was in church in Cuba just a few weeks ago, and the Christians there have experienced persecution in the not-too-distant past. It's much better now, but they can still remember it. In a number of countries, the practice of Christian faith is considered to be dangerous behaviour that threatens to destabilise the society. But it's generally not seen that way in Australia, is it? In fact, church attendance is still reasonably common among those who control the laws and the finances of this country. If you poked your head in the door at any of the big three churches on the Toorak Hill this morning, you would have been more likely to see senior bureaucrats and bankers than subversives and agitators. In our society, Christianity is seen as safe and conservative and acceptable. And I wonder whether that's actually a major factor in why it appears to be dying out. Because although there is clearly a growing hunger in our society for genuine spiritual transformation, people quite reasonably assume that Christianity is far too associated with the way things have always been to be offering anything with the power to change lives. Now, it's an unavoidable fact that the general perception of what Christianity is has been formed by what church-going people are seen to be and do. And if we are perceived as being people who live comfortably with the status quo values of our society, then I would suggest that we are a long way from the kind of Christianity that is envisaged in the readings that we just heard from Luke's Gospel and from the letter to the Hebrews. All that long list that Suzanne read out about ways that Christians were being attacked and dismembered and stuff like that. In the Gospel reading, Jesus suggested that the impact of what he was on about would be like taking to the earth with a flamethrower, that it would be seriously divisive. It would even split families as people found themselves taking opposing sides over fundamental issues of how to live. And in the letter to the Hebrews, the exercise of faith is depicted as something over which kingdoms rise and fall, and people are hounded out of towns and mercilessly persecuted. One of the things I noticed during my trip recently was that even though much of it was in countries where Christianity is probably perceived in similar ways to what it is here, I was more conscious of some of this history of persecution and so on because it's present in the churches. So many of the churches have depictions of people who were martyred on the spot where this church is built or something like that. Just 2 days ago, in the city of Chennai in India, I visited the tomb of St. Thomas, one of the 12, and there was a quite graphic depiction of him being martyred on that spot where the church now is. It seems to me that one of the reasons that we have rendered Christianity safe and innocuous is that there's been a major change in the way that we think about what faith is. Because we often think about it and talk about it as being something that you have. Do you have faith? She's got a lot of faith. You need to have a little faith. Do you have enough faith? You know, we talk like that all the time. These sorts of statements make faith sound like a possession, like something that you own. And there are lots of things that our society has decided it can tolerate people possessing. Perhaps we've actually begun to think of faith as being a little bit like marijuana. The possession of small amounts for private use is actually no longer going to get you into trouble. Just don't start trafficking it. Somehow, I don't think that either Jesus or the writer to the Hebrews was thinking of faith as something you simply possess for private consumption while keeping your head down and letting the rest of the world get on with its business. Faith is not a thing that can be possessed. It's something that you do, something that you exercise. It's something active that affects those around. Perhaps we could better compare it to power, because there's no such thing as simply possessing power without ever exercising it and without anybody else being affected by it. Power only exists in the exercising of it, in putting it into practice. So too with faith. Faith only exists as it is exercised. That's why I think it's a mistake to completely equate faith with belief. You can have a belief that has no consequences. I can believe that Noah's Ark was 450 feet long, and it's going to make absolutely no difference to the way I live my life tomorrow, whether I believe that or not. Faith is more like trust. It is belief that steps out and commits itself to action. If we say that we trust in that God's foolishness will prove wiser than the wisdom of the world, we're exercising an active choice and we're backing one side over another. We're committing ourselves to living by one and rejecting the other. And once we start to do that, the sparks begin to fly and the fires begin to break out. If we say that we are willing to trust God's radical hospitality over the world's self-protective closed border policies, we may be taking some real risks. If it means that we reject the wisdom of the world that says that this country should keep out those seeking asylum from elsewhere and instead trust that those who offer a place of welcome and refuge will be vindicated by God, we will not only find ourselves on the unpopular side of the opinion polls, but we may find ourselves breaking the law and facing arrest and public vilification. But that's what faith is. To say that we believe that something should be done, but that we're not willing to do it, unless it's popular or at least legal, is not the exercise of faith. It's the exercise of compliance. Jesus was in no doubt that his own radical faith in God was going to plunge him into a baptism of fire. And he was also quite clear that the stress and anxiety that he was going to have to endure as he approached it was real and almost intolerable. And he was under no illusions that the wholehearted living of the life of faith would make the world a nicer and peaceful place. My presence will not bring peace, he said, but will cause people to take sides one against the other. It will split families. It will divide friends. Now, all that might sound decidedly uninviting. Where's the good news? Well, both readings point to the answer. Jesus speaks of a baptism of fire, but a baptism is not only something that you are plunged into, it's also something from which you emerge with a new identity and a new life filled with God's Holy Spirit. the baptism of fire is the birthplace of new life. Similarly, the opening image of faith in tonight's reading from the Hebrews was of God's people exercising faith by passing through the Red Sea to freedom. The trauma of being trapped between an army and an uncrossable body of water was not what life was all about, but it was a situation in which the only way out was a compliant return to slavery, and the way to freedom and life would only open to those who made a massive investment of risk-defying faith. So the good news is that we are not called to face the fire for no reason, or to take the risk of faith just for the hell of it. Rather, we are called to face the fire simply because that's what lies between us and the realization of God's purposes on earth. And there's no way around. And as the writer to the Hebrews says, if we keep our eyes on Jesus and follow his lead, the vision of freedom, love, and joy to come will give us the perseverance to push on through whatever threatens to engulf us. Because that vision of a world where love and justice finally reign and all things are made one in God is the promise of the only life that is ultimately worth living and the only life worth dying for.